The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
In the limited time that we have, I would like to attempt a modest, I don't want to say feeble attempt, but certainly at best a modest attempt to deal with an issue that I believe is relevant to your communities as well. I met over Pesach with an individual, from England, who told me actually that they're involved with a type of a program there where they have a home. They take in some of these kids that have dropped out of the system, and they work with them. So I know the problem is there, and what I know that maybe you don't know is that there are untold numbers still in the pipeline that haven't surfaced yet, because that's our experience, that when you see a group of kids falling out of the yeshiva system, it just is a forerunner of what's in the system and on the way out and yet has not been able to be detected. So I imagine learning better how to detect would be helpful. Learning what to do with these people would be helpful, but probably more critical and certainly more long-range beneficial would be developing whatever things we could do to improve the system to avoid, to prevent these things from happening. So that's really what this is about. I'm going to leave you, when I leave, with one of these things, which are basically some outlines of some of the issues. I learned many years ago, you don't give these things out first, because then everybody is reading, and you don't have any audience other than the tape. So, forgive me. But even before we begin, just in case I forget, one of the things that we have gotten involved in, and this is really planting a seed even before we start, that we found that has helped crystallize the focus on what they call here, in a cliche, very tritely, youth at risk, yeshiva kids at risk. Some people say we're all at risk, on one level or another, but there are certainly kids who are seriously almost completely be identified that there's a very serious risk, and the risk we're talking about is leaving the derech completely, leaving a healthy lifestyle, drugs and alcohol and everything that goes with that, and these are serious things. One of the things that we've done is we've sponsored quite a number of conferences for parents, for teachers, for rabbonim, to raise the issue and to bring people who are interested together with so-called professionals, people who've been working in this field, and besides sharing ideas and hearing and getting some advice, a lot of benefit has come out of it. And I think that focus and awareness and some good solid advice has been a benefit that everyone has had. This is about an old conference that was done a couple of years ago. I thought I'd just plant the idea as something that that would be worthwhile, for you people to consider for your communities. And of course, there are people here who I think would be thrilled at the opportunity to participate and to try to share their experiences. Anyway, okay, let's begin. We have a serious problem. And I think it only makes sense for me to talk about our communities, and I say the United States, because it's not New York, and it's not just California, it's not Florida, it's not Chicago, it's all of the above, and many more. It's a little unfair to speak about your community since I know nothing about it, or next to nothing, but I believe that we live in a day and age that what's happening by you is soon going to happen by us, and what's happening by us is almost happening by you, and the Atlantic Ocean is really not a very formidable distance as it used to be. So I think it's all relevant. We're living in a situation today where I would say that we have a serious, serious problem. Large numbers, thousands in the metropolitan area alone, of yeshiva kids from across the spectrum in the Orthodox community, from right to left, are falling out, dropping out of yeshiva, dropping out of connection with Yiddishkeit, oftentimes dropping out of their homes and their family life, getting involved with all kinds of inappropriate, illegal, and dangerous substances and involvements and lifestyles, and extremely serious. Probable culprit, if we had to single out one, would be the success that we've achieved. Again, I don't know how it is in your communities, but here in New York, and even in many communities in the United States, we're the establishment. I mean, you know, the Orthodox community is, we have a presence, and it's recognized, and it's it has clout, political clout, and certainly financial clout, and you know, and I mean, you walk up and down the avenue, you got 40 kosher establishments here that you could, I don't want to interfere with your plans, but you got 40 kosher establishments, you know, that you can choose from, and this is a, you know, not an atypical neighborhood. This is what's going on. The yeshivas are bulging. I remember as a kid when the yeshivas would fight for one student on a 20%, you know, scholarship. And today, you're on a waiting list. You know, you're lucky if you're on a waiting list. It's like, and therefore the classes are bulging. And therefore, we're dealing with many kids, large numbers, and Kinayin Ahara, and I wrote this once, and I have to edit it. I couldn't even publish what I wrote, because I said one of the problems is the large size of our families. Someone who read it said, "What are you recommending?" You know, like, but so I have to, but the truth of the matter is we have to address that. You know, it's not the same if you got four kids or three kids or two kids, or if you got 10 kids, and to know, you know, where do you know where your children are, you know, at any given moment. So this is all, you know, these are issues. And this is, Baruch Hashem, is great. This is success. But the success has bred serious problems. I think the major, the underlying nekuda of the problem, probably at least in my experience more than anything else, is we have lost the focus on the individuality of each student, of each child. In a classroom of 30 or 25 or whatever it may be, you know, it's hard for a Rebbe, it's hard for a teacher to focus on that individuality. In a moesed that instead of having 250 kids has 800 kids or whatever, it's hard for a principal or even an assistant principal and, you know, five people on staff to focus on that individuality, because there's so much going on, there's so many numbers and so forth. I love to say how to underscore how important individuality is that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was informed in I think it's in the middle of Parshas Pinchas by Chamishi, that he's going to pass on and that he needs a successor, so he turns to the Rabbeinu Shalom to ask for his successor. The first item on a short list of four requests, Vayomer Moshe el Hashem, Yifked Hashem Elokei Horuchos L'chol Boso, Ish Al Ha'Edom. So Rashi's bothered by Elokei Horuchos L'chol Boso, what's for Ashprachimus? He says, Rabbeinu Shalom, Golu V'yodu Alefonecho. You know that every person is different. You should appoint a manig sheyuchol lizbol, I believe he says. Das kol echad echad. It's a sevel. It's you have to have a lot of savlonus. It's not easy, but das kol echad echad. This is for a manig of millions of people. There were 2-3 million people there, and this is the first item on the short list of requirements to be able to deal with, to understand. For a manik to be able to deal and to tolerate with each individual, that's really the most important requirement. Unfortunately, in today's system, it's very difficult. And I think this is the cause of so many problems. Why? Because from our experience, and I guess my analysis of the situation is that there are kids that are positioned for failure. Positioned for failure doesn't mean you're going to fail. From a position for failure, you can succeed to the highest heights. In fact, sometimes the position for failure can catapult you to the highest heights. but depends what happens. Position for failure could be there are a lot of kids with learning disabilities that just don't get recognized, don't get treated, don't get the attention that they need. There are kids with psychological or emotional issues that just, you know, not talking about the heavy stuff, but just, you know, inability to, you know, we used to think all the problems were, what were they, you know, years ago, it was a problem of chutzpah and zitzfleish. That's all, right? That's the two diagnoses. Today they're a little more sophisticated, you know. There's probably a thousand diagnoses, and many of them are relevant to what's going on. So there's kids. There are kids that have trauma in their lives, which is really overwhelming them and causing them to fall to failure. And if not recognized and addressed and guided and helped and, you know, supported, can be very, very painful. There's, you know, divorce in families, which is a very, I don't know how the situation is over there. Hopefully it should be better than here, but over here it's so commonplace. It's when it comes to shidduchim for some of our yeshiva bochrim, many, many from divorced homes. So I tell people, you know, I say, like, it's not what it used to be. The stigma is not the same. The psychological the challenges are not the same because it's so common, you know. It's like, so, and this is, but it hurts, and there's an effect, and we have to address this. And there are just many kids that have, and it's not a very professional diagnosis, a mind of their own. Minds of their own are not too highly respected in our yeshiva world today. You know, like, it's just, because there's no time, part of it. Too many other kids. Too many other kids, and I'm afraid that the mind of their own will stimulate thought and discussion and ideas, and I won't be able to deal with all of it, and who knows what. See, if I have three kids and a guy speaks his mind, then I could deal with the other two and see how it affected them and how to cope and compensate, but I don't know. And I'm not, and there's no fault of anyone in these things. These are just facts of life. So we have these kids who are positioned for failure. Now, if we would address, if we would be able, capable, knowledgeable, equipped to address these problems early on, a lot of things could be different. You know, there are a lot of kids. I came at this conference. We had this Arachim conference where we sent our guys this Shabbos. Is for frum people. But it's like more of an educational thing, and, you know, for the frum community, and, you know, to interest them in what's going on. And so many people came over with, I got a 4-year-old who's not interested in Yiddishkeit. I was like, like, what are you talking about? You know, I didn't know how to relate to that question exactly. But, I mean, we take in young kids, but not, you know. But these things have to be addressed. Now, nothing to panic. Like, why should he be interested? You know what I mean? Basically, but maybe if a parent gets a little guidance, for example, well, that's what it was. My kid, Shabbos, he hates Shabbos because he can't play with his electronic toys. What do I do? And she's panicking. So then she admits after the conversation, she says, well, I let him play now. Which, by the way, may not be such a bad answer, because the kid's going to... So I told her, I says, why don't you take the kid on a shopping spree in Toys R Us? You know? Tell her we're going to buy Shabbos toys. Like, I'm going to have $100 or $200. I don't know. It looked like money was not the object of this particular person. And we're going to... You know, I let the kid... So two things happen. Number one, you're being positive, not negative. Number two, you're giving him an element of choice. In other words, I'm going to choose the things that I, you know, so you're taking off that pressure. But here's the thing with a little kid, and this kid could develop, you know, if with our, especially, you know, I should have mentioned it in our, in the success. Part of our success is also our sincerity. We're so sincere with our kids, and that, you know, like, we can't, to tell you, I don't know if I should, you know, put this on tape, but I got a little bit of an education as my kids got older and started, you know, marrying and so forth. One of my kids told me a couple of years ago, he said to me, I said, you know, I was quite liberal as a parent, you know, from my society, whatever. And he says, what? I says, what do you mean? I didn't stop you from doing anything. I mean, like, he says, no, you don't understand. He says, we knew how passionately you wanted certain things and how passionately you were against certain things, and no matter what you let us do, we couldn't do anything. And if we did something, we'd be miserable all the time. So But you have to have passion. If there's no passion in the home for Yiddishkeit, then you're not gonna, they're not going to catch that passion. On the other hand, the passion is creating more pressure. So, you know, like, what?
Yeah. But they have to care that you care.
This is it. They
have to bother them that you care.
Okay. Okay.
One.
Okay. Well, you won and you lose. Yeah. It's a balance. Listen, there's no simple solution. But this creates problems because many people who care so much are putting on pressure. People don't like pressure. I mean, by the way, none of us like pressure. Why do you think we have to be Mekabel Malchus Shemayim twice a day? The Ramban says, so the Ramban of the North says, he brings a Mechilta, Moshe Lemelech, that comes to a city. The Melech said, the people say, Melech, Gzoiro Leinu Gzeiros. So the Melech says, Im Malchusi Iatem Mekablim, Hech Tekaimu Gzeiroisai. If you're not going to accept my Malchus, how are you going to do the Gzeiros? Shaila is, they said, Gzoiro Leinu Gzeiros, they're begging, they're asking for it. Im Malchusi Iatem Mekablim. I say, you have to first be Mekabel Malchus Shemayim before you're focused on the Gzeiros. Because once you see the pressure, the limitations, the restrictions in an overwhelming sense, I can't handle it. But first, Mekabel Malchus Shemayim. It's almost like Naseh v'Nishma, you know, like, Onoich Hashem, Olekech Hashem, Tzitzich, Sholem Aleichem. I'm the one who took you out of Israel. Okay, fine. Now we'll start Lo Yelecho. There has to be a Kabbalah Sol Malchus Shemayim in the abstract. And Nitnodos. Nitnodos, and I think this is a very important important issue in this whole thing. When you finish Kabbalah Sol Malchus Shemayim, the Gemara says, Emes V'yatziv D'Raisa. What do we say? Emes V'yatziv V'nochoyim V'kayom V'yoshor V'ne'emon V'yohu V'chovi V'nechmod V'noyim V'no'adi. It's strong, it's true, it's real, it's beautiful, it's sweet, it's precious. We have to have that sense. We! Every single day to be mekabel the malchus shemayim before we mekabel the old mitzvahs, just to think in the abstract, not thinking about the pressure. And after all of that, we have to say, oh, it's real, it's true, it's true, it's for real, it's beautiful, it's sweet, it's precious. Nechmod, noim, sukon, mekubel, toy v'yofe. This is because pressure is very, very difficult. Anyway, so these are some of the problems that position our kids for failure. What can we do about them? Well, the doing about it really is in three stages. The first stage, of course, is probably the most long-range critical stage is prevention. Next stage is early detection. Because even if we couldn't prevent, but if we could detect problems earlier on, then, you know, that would be helpful. And of course, the third stage, and I guess the only fair name to apply to that is crisis intervention. You know, after you've detected a problem and you see that, what's doing? What do you do? And these are some of the areas which I think are critical. A lot of this is, there are outlines that deal with a lot of these things in this this thing that I'm going to leave with you. Well, prevention. I think that's the most critical, because prevention is also, in the limited time we have, I think most important, because prevention in one way or another really works at all stages. Because even if you didn't prevent, much of the prevention technique is what's needed when you recognize the problem as well. And even when you're dealing with crisis, and crisis intervention may oftentimes necessitate certainly more professional help, but some of the issues are the same. There's another interesting and potentially very important and beautiful thing that's going on here, and that's a rehab, which a drug rehab under Orthodox auspices. It's called the Yatskan Center. It's out in Amityville, you know, on the island. And one of the things that they're working now very hard to do is, besides the professional work that they have to do in terms of this, but to provide an alternative religious program that can inspire and that can help and guide and fill the void that these kids have. So even in a state where they are really, I mean, these kids that are addicted, these are kids that they stay there sometimes. It used to be the minimum was 10 months. Now they're adjusting that. But they need, and they will be receptive to the right spiritual and emotional and educational stimuli if we know how to deal with it. So prevention is, I think, extremely important. I'd like to speak for a few moments about that. The simple stuff that everybody knows, I heard the word mentioned as you people walked in here, is still all-powerful. But it's not enough. The most popularized word, and everybody knows it, miseichel, is love. But love is all-powerful. Just to give you a little moshul of how powerful it is, Yaakov is meeting, Esav is coming to meet Yaakov. They haven't met for so many years. Esav is coming with his army. Yaakov is concerned, preparing himself. One of the things he does, he sends a shliach to tell him, The Ralbag in the Toyelius says that Yaakov, that you learn from Yaakov Avinu how to melt the heart of a mortal enemy. How do you melt the heart of a mortal enemy? Show friendship. You show friendship, love on guaranteed, so you know, the gift and the whole seaport, everything. Shaila is, it doesn't make any sense. Esav held that Yaakov was fooling him day and night. He's going to believe that now Yaakov is serious? Well, Nachman, he's coming with 400 soldiers and he only has his four wives and his little kids there. What's going on? And Bechlal, what did he tell him? He told him deep personal secrets. He says, I was with Lavan, I had Tzoyin, but he told him as Behemoth. What is that? When the hatred that Esav had to Yaakov is chokuk b'teva Esav saying to Yaakov, that became mamish halacha, the Gemara says. So you're talking about the worst hatred in the world to be melted by a show of friendship that's completely incredible. He's not going to believe him, and he's not showing any great friendship anyway. Vice versa, that love and friendship are so powerful that even if the recipient is stone, and even if he's mesupik, that probably it's not true, there's a chance. Maybe he taka loves me. Maybe. It's enough to melt the heart of the greatest enemy. It's enough to penetrate the greatest resistance. So, no question about it. The problem is, I think that love is sometimes misunderstood and overrated as the sole solution to problems. And let me tell you what I mean. Parents, I tell parents oftentimes that your love is really not what it's about. They get very offended, like, what do you mean? It's very simple. The dynamic of love, the psychodynamic, I'm not sure that's the right word, but of the effect that love has on a person is that I feel good about myself. Because you love me, I must be choshu. The Sipuno defines love as sheyismach oyev b'malas ane'av. If you love me, I'm choshev. Wow. If a person feels good about himself, everything is good in life. Happiness is really about feeling good about yourself. That's what it is. The definition of happiness is feeling good about yourself. My self-ego, self-esteem, self-image, all these things, feeling good about yourself, within yourself. Not about the things that I have for myself, not about the pleasures that I can afford to indulge in, not about the things that I indulge myself in, but about myself. And everything else is just a substitute covering over that lack of happiness. Anyway, my parent loves me. My mother loves me. My mother loves me. She's paid for it. It's a job. And not only is it a job, it's b'teva. She doesn't have a choice. Like, what does it do? And now, if you don't get love from a parent, that does an awful lot to destroy your self-image. But it isn't the most powerful thing for self-image. But when my Rebbe loves me, when my Rav loves me, when my mentor loves me, even when my friends accept me and love me, when outside people who are not on the payroll, who it's not demanded and expected, it's not so taken for granted, that says something to my self-image. So one of the things that we have to get away from is assuming that a loving, warm, caring home is going to do everything for our children. It's not, because the positive love of a parent is not positive enough. The negative will kill a kid, no question. It's not positive enough to take away from the devastation that a kid can feel by seeing a Rebbe who's, you know, dumping on him, is attacking him, or friends that don't accept him, or community people that comes to shul and everybody is making fun of the way he looks or the way he talks or the way he acts. All of these things can devastate kids. And therefore, the love alone, as powerful as it is, at home it's not enough, it needs more. And this really needs an awareness in the Moistas HaChinuch and in our shuls and in the general community. I mean, how beautiful it is when, I mean, and kids have told me this, I walked into this shul, nobody says boo to me. I walked into this shul, everybody comes over to me and says hello to me, and they greet me and they're friendly with me. Wow, and he's coming back next week. Whatever you have there, he'll be there. You know, you need a minion during the week, it's in the winter for mincha, chleis vos, you know, he'll be there. It makes him feel good. And these are things that our people have to be aware of. So I think this is certainly a critical element, but it's not the whole story. We spoke before about individualization. There has to be an awareness that one program, actually, I have it here, I'll show it to you in a moment. I guess it's becoming more popular, the concept of, in Jewish education, one size doesn't fit all. One size can't fit all. It's not like those bathrobes, I don't know where you're staying, that they give in the fancy hotels, you know. They get a one size fit all, and if you take it home, they charge your credit card for who knows what. What's that?
No fancy hotels.
Okay, better that way. More Hamish. Anyway, so
you too.
One size doesn't fit all. And we must be sensitive to that with our own children. We must caution and educate our balabatim that they have to be sensitive to that with their children. And you know, you see, Baruch Hashem, part of the success that we have really could be used to our advantage, because there are so many different types of schools and shades of schools that really a parent has some opportunities and some choice. But the choice is not only for the parent. The kid has to feel he has choices. One of the things that I one of my finest hours in Chinuch that I'm very proud of, I say it over all the time, there was a guy who was going to make a choice. I knew that he was going to make a choice that was going to destroy him. Destroy him. And I couldn't get him off it. I just couldn't get him off it. And the alternative was something that he really didn't want. He wasn't ready for. I developed a bogus alternative, which could never be lo hoyo v'lo yiyeh. But it was enough to say, hey, you know, but let's think about it. Maybe that. Ah, you mean it's not? I'm not compelled to do this. All of a sudden, he chose the right one. Compelling, like we said, that mitzvah v'yoseh. We have to provide individuality, and we have to provide choices for our kids. Even if it's only a question, even if whatever areas, I mean, like I suggested with this little kid, choice of which toys he wants to buy. In learning, you know, any time, let's say you want your kid to learn extra. So we're going to learn this. No, what would you rather learn? Even though it might be educationally better in terms of his total chinuch to learn this instead of this, but if he has a gishmak for that, and if it's his choice, you'll gain so much more because you take off that pressure. And at least, if we can't give choices in every area of life, if we can't individualize in every area of life, at least let the kid feel that there are some areas where he has some individuality and some choice. Something. And it's so important. But the truth of the matter is, it goes much beyond that. We have to recognize the individual. Not every kid is ready for every directive. Some kids will. I mean, parents, you know, especially over the Shabbos, I also hear a lot of parents that they want their kid to learn that when the parent says, you got to do. Now, there are kids that can learn that lesson, and it'll do them well, and it's appropriate, and they'll live with it, and fine. There are kids that you're not going to teach that lesson to. It's just not gonna, this kid is a contrary, you know? that's a Mary, Mary, quite contrary. I don't know if that's part of your cultural background. I don't think it's part of ours anymore either, but I guess I'm from a different generation, you know? But that's it, you know? There are people that are contrary, you know? They're just anything you tell them. They'll say, fakir. So you got to be smart. Tell them the thing you don't want them to do, and then, you know, and then you're a winner. But so we have to be able to deal with these kids. In the classroom, we have to be able to deal with these kids. In the home, we have to. He doesn't want to do what everybody else has to do. You got to talk to them. You got to explain to them. You got to deal with it. There's not simple solutions. Sometimes there are no solutions. But and sometimes you have to lose battles. You can't win all the battles. But if we put that sense of you gotta fit, for example, one of the most blatant examples is dress. You know, I don't know how it is again in your communities, but in a lot of the yeshiva world today, everybody has to dress alike. And even those that tolerate individual differences, if you really notice how they're dressed, they're all dressed alike differently. The differently is all alike. You know what I mean? These kids are dressed differently, so they got holes in their clothing. But the holes are all in the same place. So there's also a culture there. For some people, that's great. If it's their culture, that's one thing, if they chose it. But, you know, but not everybody could do that. I mean, there are parents here, and part of, I think, what we have to guide people, I think, is very critical, is that... Part of the lack of ability to focus on the individual has to do with our own personal negius. Society, social, friends, reputation. Of course, the big one is shiduchim for the other kids. If my kid, and again, I don't know how it goes by you, if my kid is seen wearing this kind of a yarmulke, if my kid is seen wearing this color shirt, if my kid is seen with his, I don't know what, that's it, forget it, his sister's never going to get married. I'm kafira besides everything else. It's not true, but that's besides the point, you know. But and yes, it's a problem. Yes, you have to take it into consideration. But you can't kill the kid because you're choishish. Maybe the sister won't get the same shlif. It's ain't sofik meitzvi devada. It just doesn't work. And we have to be willing. And the same thing in the classroom. A rebbe has to teach the whole class, and everybody has to do it. And everybody, you got this one kid. I know, for example, I'm just trying to find quickly some examples. This kid I had just recently with a principal and a kid. The kid has to lean against the wall. Well, the rebbe feels it's a bit offensive for a kid to sit back and lean against the wall. But the rebbe knew this kid can't sit any other way. I'm really amazed getting to know this kid that he could sit at all. And all he really needs to do is to sit like this, you know, forget the damage does to the walls, so charge his parents, have it fixed every 6 months. But you see, now, sometimes if that's going to destroy a class, you can't allow it. But even then, you have to explain to, we'll get to that in a moment maybe, but certain things you can't allow. And you know something, Rebbe? If you wouldn't make such a big issue, probably nobody would notice it. But we make a big issue and it becomes a thing because he's not fitting the mold. And so these are things we must allow as much as possible. And when we can't allow, we must explain why we can't allow. And here I would like to come to another thing which I think is very, very important. Discipline, everybody knows, is extremely important. Without discipline, not only can you not run a group, you can't even live an individual life. Everybody has to develop discipline. But not everybody can be disciplined in the same way. Because discipline is very painful. What discipline really means is, in Mamaloshin, is you're telling me what to do. And I resent that. I don't want to be told what to do by anybody. You know, we don't want to be told to do by the Rebbeinu Shalom, therefore we got to be Mekabel the Baruch Hashemayim first, and Emes V'yatziv V'nochoyim V'kayom V'toy V'yofet, because we don't want discipline. That's what we're about too, so what do you want from our kids? Not discipline. So discipline has to be done. Now, discipline with a smile is not enough. Discipline with a statement, you know, you hit the kid and you say, well, it hurts me more than it hurts you, that doesn't go today. For the last 50 years, nobody ever convinced the kid that it hurts them more than it hurts them, you know, but when you beat them up,
they keep doing the experiment.
What's that? They keep doing the experiment. Okay. What's that?
They can divorce you for it now.
Really? Wow. Okay.
It's done in Europe. They take you to the European court.
I heard about that.
And
wow. Anyway, so Lemaisa, but there are a few things that can work with discipline. One is like this: any psychological mechanism that will reduce the pressure is going to help. Because what discipline really is, it's a pressure, and it's a pressure that says, what's the dynamic of this pressure? The pressure says like this: you're pushing me, and you're forcing me to do what you want. That means I'm nothing. That's again, self-esteem, I'm nothing. Hello, what am I? You control me, I'm a puppet. You go like this, that's it, it's a puppet. So people don't want to be puppets, people don't want to feel good about myself, I want to do what I make. So you've got to provide a way, or devise ways, that the discipline is not as threatening to one's individuality, to one's self-esteem. How could you do that? How could that be done? Well, there are a number of things that can be done. Number one, just simply explaining the reason for rules can mitigate that pressure. This is the rule, you have to do it, it's absolute, but I'm going to tell you why it's good, and hopefully not just why it's good for me, because that really doesn't make me feel too good, but why it's good for you. If I can present discipline in a way that's good for you, you could see, hey, it's to your benefit. Sometimes that only means it's to the whole group's benefit, but you as an individual will benefit by such standards, because then the other one will also have to abide by that standard, and you will be able to have the kinds of things that you want. So whatever it is, a group dynamic, society, you know, tikkun achmas amadinas, I think the Nesilas Shoren calls it, just that the society should continue to function. There are certain things, but explain it, because explaining it does a few things. Number one, it takes off the harshness. You're explaining it. Number two, it makes it rational. Number three, since it's rational, it can become my choice. It's like, I'm not doing it because you told me. I am doing it because it makes sense. So it mitigates that. And if you'll say that undermines the kovod and the appropriate attitude and the marus and the sense of realization of control and COVID and derech eretz that one should have, I'm going to try to dispel that thought with the following. The Sefer HaChinuch, which is mamish like an unbelievable asset, I believe, in and not only the Chinuch, but his whole derech in Chinuch today, but we'll see. Sefer HaChinuch, as you, I'm sure, know, it was a bar mitzvah gift to his bar mitzvah book. I don't know what you people do for bar mitzvahs over there, but it's a far cry from what happens in bar mitzvahs over here. But Lemaisa, that was his gift for his bar mitzvah book. And in it, he explained to him each one of the Taryag mitzvahs, and he gave him what he calls the Sheirish HaMitzvah, which is, in his language, in many places, is Tam V'Toyeles. The reason, and the reason oftentimes, I saw once from Rabbi Gifter, it's the taste, the geschmack. That's why it's called Tamei HaMitzvahs. The mitzvah can have the same hashpah, but it's geschmack when it has a taste. That's the taste, the reason. The tam, and the toeles, the benefit that's in it. And if you notice in the Sefer HaChinuch, the benefits that he talks about are bishvili, the benefit for the individual. He doesn't talk about cosmic, global, mystical, metaphysical benefits. He talks about, it's going to make my life and make me happy, because that's really all people want, is to be happy, make me feel good, make my life better. Okay, now, he comes to us, so he did this on all the mitzvahs, Taryag mitzvahs. He comes to one mitzvah in Parshas Vayikra of Kol Sor V'Kol Dvash Leisaktiru Ish El Hashem. On this mitzvah, he says, I don't know the Talmud. He doesn't know the reason. And he says, I was not going to write a reason. Finally, he writes something and he begs the Kohen shouldn't be teifus all of, you know, don't hit me too hard on this one, because I'm really not sure of it. I came up with something. Why? So he says like this: I'm afraid if I don't give tam v'toyeles to the mitzvahs, then the Torah will appear to my child and his friends as a sefer chosum. It's closed. It doesn't make sense. And what's going to happen? Pen, and I quote, Pen yivatu bohem mitoich kach b'na'arusom v'yanichum le'oilom v'yelchu lahevel. He says, I'm afraid that they will rebel against all the mitzvahs, bin arusam, beita, loshen, kicking. They'll kick it, kick the habit, they'll kick it off. The anichum, not stam, they'll go off the derech, they'll come back. The anichum le'olam, the yelchul ha'hevel, and I imagine 500 years ago when he lived, what kind of hevel was there in the world, you know? But he's afraid. This is a child who grew up in the house of one of, we don't know exactly who he was, but one of the gedolei harishonim. This is a child who grew up in a world that was somewhat normal and chaste 500 years ago. This is a child whose bar mitzvah gift contained within it the benefit and the reason for each one of the tariag mitzvahs, maybe for aduma as a shayla, whether he really gives a reason there, but everything else, 611, 612 of the mitzvahs. This was a child who has all of this, and you're not giving him the reason on a mitzvah that's most likely not negea, because he'll have to have first the Beis HaMikdosh before he's going to have the Isra of bringing Sur and Vash on the Mizbeach. So it's not like he's going to be doing it and he won't have a reason, he's going to rebel against it. And the Baal HaChinuch is afraid that if he doesn't write Tam V'Toyeles, Gishmak, reason and benefit for his kid, that he's going to rebel against all the mitzvahs, leave the whole Yiddishkeit forever in a matzav. That doesn't mean for sure it's going to happen, but he's afraid, and therefore he writes something that's not up to his standard of truth and that he would rather not have written. So here's something that's very interesting. The Sefer HaChinuch doesn't dispute the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says Hevel Mishamshin Esarav Shalom Manas Lekabel Pras. You know, Al Tiyu Kavod Mishamshin Esarav Manas Lekabel Pras. Hevel Shalom Manas Lekabel Pras. And we know that the Lishmo of Mitzvahs is to do it Ach Verak because the Rebbeinu Shalom said so. But even a person who is learning eventually that matzav, or maybe he's even holding by that, but the initial encounter has to have a certain gishmak. He has to feel good about it. He can't feel pressured. He can't feel, I must do it, and it don't make no sense, and I got to do it anyway. And if he has that, he'll be able to rise to the level of doing it l'shem mitzvah, of doing it because the Rebbeinu Shalom said so. Because when I develop a full confidence in that Rebbeinu Shalom and in his Torah, same thing a kid. If I really had confidence in my parent, if youth wasn't so, if the generation gap wasn't so wide and kids had more confidence in their parents, they wouldn't mind as much listening to what their parents tell them. But after they develop that confidence, until that they have to hear explanations, the explanations give them that confidence, and the explanations make it easier because it takes off the pressure. It allows me that even though ultimately there's an authority there, but it allows me that sense of, you know, I'm doing this also because it makes sense. A little bit because it makes sense. Well, at least it makes sense. So it takes off the sting of that lachatz, and that makes life so much easier for these kids. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Can I ask you on that? Because, I mean, years ago, children didn't have to have that approach. There were normal Jewish children grew up in, say, from homes, whether it was in discipline in the home or discipline in the school, that we were able, parents were able to create an atmosphere of kibbutz and yira, both for the parents and the teachers and so on, and it worked. Now, right across the board, whether it's from or non-from, you hear all over that some people say it's gone forever. And, you know, I still can't get my mind around why. I know they're subject to external influences. You know, they're not impervious to anything, even the frumous kids with the internet and so on. But what is it that's culturally changed today? Why can't you still create a climate whereby parents can give over midas and discipline as it used to be?
That's an excellent question. I appreciate the question. Let me just try to comment a few things. Number one, just to put in perspective, the Chinuch is writing 500 years ago. So at all times, it was always an element of a need for this, you know, reason and explanation. Mm-hmm. However, today it's to an extreme. In other words, your question really brings out the point that if the Chinuch is worried about this, we should panic, you know, and make sure that we...
If you will ask my son, there's not good to answer that you would ask with me.
Well,
he was honest with his honesty. He said if he had people with something which came through in the chinuch, because sometimes he did say, please don't ask this question because...
Okay, but on this particular one, he says, I must write because I'm afraid of this. So even though sometimes he maybe that was also a pedagogical technique, you know. But here he says clearly he's afraid of these results. Anyway, so but I just like to address that. I think in a sense you really answered the question too, because it has to do with the mood in society in general. And I would like to, this is a theory, but then again, so is Darwin. I'd like to blame it all on Darwin. The breakdown of all discipline and all sense of shibud and all sense of authority in our society is all to be blamed on Darwin. And if you think about it historically, it's correct, because until that point, everybody was religious, basically. I mean, you always had rebels, but there was no such thing as you know, it was it. There was one religion, another religion, they substituted, they changed, they philosophized, but there was, what happened? Very simple. And that's why Darwin is getting away with so much. Whereas from a scientific point of view, and I'm not a scientist, but I speak sometimes to some world-class scientists, and they say that, you know, it's overrated. There's no justification. Why? Very simple. If we are products of creation that immediately represents a sense of purpose and responsibility to that purpose. That's what it is. If there's a creation, creation bespeaks purpose, because you create for a purpose, and purpose means responsibility to fulfill that purpose. If we are the product of accident, everything goes. Wonderful. Do what you want. There is taka, no logical reason if we're the product of an accident why we shouldn't do whatever we please. And my product of an accident can fight your product of an accident, and if I choose to wipe you off the face of the earth altogether, who's to say I'm wrong? Because we're all here by accident anyway, so...
Survival of the fittest.
That's right. Very good, very good. I didn't think of that. Very good. Right. That's what it is. That's my definition. That's what it is. Now, by the way, Agav, and I think this is important too, but it's not the essence, but it's something, a message that sometimes has to get out there. I once gave a lecture, I called it From Darwin to Prozac. I don't know what you call it in England. Prozac, okay. So from Darwin to Prozac. Why? And I blamed not only the moral decadence and loss of authority in this world on Darwin, but I also blamed the sad state of human mental health on Darwin. It's the same thing. Why? Why did everybody embrace Darwin? Because we're an accident. I'm free. No purpose. I can do what I want. The problem is, Rabbi Isai, that man needs purpose. You know the famous Viennese psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, who wrote this book, Man's Search for Meaning. I think the bottom line of everything he says there is that the ultimate human problem that makes people depressed and is you need purpose in life. And in a corollary, he says, you need responsibility towards that purpose too. Because without responsibility, there's a global purpose, but it has nothing to do with me. Responsibility to a purpose, that's what makes human beings happy. We need purpose because we're made of body and soul, and the soul needs that sense of purposeful fulfillment.
He didn't have a purpose. He gave him a purpose. Yeah. That's what we're doing.
Very good.
With all this, as well as Darwinism, also the technological revolution and the conveyor belt. A person loses their value now. You need a robot to do the same thing as a person. A computer can do the same
That's
thing.
Right. That's right. That's right. So we're nothing. Yeah. So anyway, so I think so. Number one, this is a cause of terrible depression in this world, because without purpose, and why did everybody embrace it? Because we wanted freedom. Because we thought freedom's going to make us happy. Freedom makes a behemoth happy. But a human being needs purpose. Anyway, but in terms of your thing, I think the pshat is like this, that once the world is so free, you know, everything is free. There's no concept of authority. So here we come in, and we're going to tell our kids, so in the first grade or in the first years of life, 3-4 years old, you know, then finally the kid sees, well, I got to listen to my parents. He goes over here and he sees, you know, nothing.
Things have changed in the last, say, 20 or 30 years. There's been a dramatic change, one feels. You speak to educationists, you speak to discipline in the schools. All right, they say that. And the full schools where parents are supposed to teach them, and they do.
Yeah. But it takes a while. I mean, we're catching up with the general society. We're falling prey to its influence. You know, but Baruch Hashem, it's taken, maybe a century, but it's getting there. I mean, I don't know if this is the total analysis, but I think that there's definitely a mood out there of a lack of having to be told what to do, and therefore it becomes very, very difficult. Now, I must tell you, there's a story that I love to tell, which it's only partially relevant here, but I think it has some benefit. Many years ago, I lived for many years in California. I remember standing on a line in a supermarket there where they have all these goodies by the checkout, so the mother, by the time she finishes with her little kid, has another $10 bill, and this kid is pulling this, and the other thing, and the mother's saying, you can't have it, and the kid says, why not? And the mother says, because I said so, and the kid says, this is a six-year-old kid. The kid says, who are you? And the mother says, I'm your mother. And the kid says, so what? And sure enough, he got everything he wanted. A few days later, I saw the same scene with another kid. The only difference the other kid was, he was wearing a yarmulke. That was the whole difference. And I saw the same thing. The kid's pulling this. The mother says, you can't have it. The kid says, why not? The mother says, because it's not kosher. And that was the end of the story. Now, if we can acclimate our children, as the Chinuch says, with a sense of this is good for me, and there's a divine authority that mandates it, then we have the best of both worlds. It's good for me, and it's non-negotiable. See, if it's just good for me in stomp discipline, you say it's good for me, I disagree. But with the divine, you can't disagree. So if I can realize that the divine directives are good for me and be happy with that, and then I have the authority that makes it absolute, it's a winning combination. Anyway, this is I think some of the issues in terms of giving an appreciation and dealing with the individual and knowing that pressure is very difficult, and trying to explain things. And the truth of the matter is, and I wanted to get this in, you'll forgive me, I borrowed this phrase, I found it in some computer advertisement, but not only can we not say one size doesn't fit all when we say that, but the truth is, one size fits none. Because our best kids would also be better if we took some of these principles and applied it to their lives. If they had that sense of empowerment, if they had that sense of not having to fight a discipline or resent it, if they had that sense of being an individual. I mean, the kids today, the average kid in the class, I mean, the middle of the class hopefully succeeds, you know, I don't mean the middle academically, but I mean not the kids that we really can't deal with, and not the other kids that we don't have to deal with, but these kids, they do so much better if they were treated as individuals. If we'd listen to them, if we talk to them. And I think this brings us to something else. Someone just told me an example. I don't remember what it was, but anyway, we got to talk to people as individuals. We got to hear them out. One of the biggest complaints that I hear from the kids who've gone off the derech, and on a normal day of the week, you know, on a weekday, we couldn't sit here for 10 minutes straight because they'd be barging in here and this, and you'd see sights that I'm glad, in fact, that you came on Sunday. See sights that, fortunately, you can't see the yeshiva guys because they're away, but this element, and what's beautiful is the way they work together. Integrated with all the professional help and everything that we think we know what we're doing and everything, the main hashpah on these kids is this marriage guys. They tell me, these guys changed their lives. And that's one of the problems we have with the girls' school, because we don't have a girls' based medrash, you know. So we have to find some type of mentor system over there. We have a little bit in place, but it's just a couple. Anyway, so...
Could you elaborate a little on the setup here? You're referring to
this setup. Well, what this is, the truth is, this is a very different place. I don't know if you'll find another one like it. We made a decision a couple of years ago, and I'm recoiling a little bit from that decision and reevaluating it, but we made a decision a couple of years ago that we must have the we must have the at-risk kids, call them that, and these are kids who have been dropped out. These are kids who have been in five yeshiva high schools in 3 years, you know, kids who not the heavy, we have, there's another division that deals with the real drug problems, but some of them still have drug issues. Certainly Yiddishkeit is a battle for them, for many of them. There are other battles that they have, you know, and rebelliousness and problems at home, and there's a lot of need for counseling and for this. But what we made the decision was is that the big biggest asset that we have to help these kids is our normal, regular B'nai Torah Yeshiva Bochrim. Some of them actually serve as counselors at this Camp Extreme that they have, where they take kids in trouble and they take them touring. And we realize that these kids, you know, with these kids working together with them, they form bonds with these kids. That I'm, in fact, I learned a lesson many years ago when I first came to Los Angeles. I was a young guy, just out of Quelo, and I really thought this was 1975. I thought I could conquer the world. And I brought with me five Beis Medrash guys, 18-year-old, kimat, hanging by a hair, that the yeshiva they came from, that was very happy, like the yeshiva, I think, wanted to honor me at the next dinner for taking these guys away, you know, not exactly, but you know what I mean. And they were kum-kum that they were holding themselves as yeshiva bochum. In 3 months, I realized that these guys had much more hashpah on all the kids in the community than I had. And I was wounded. I thought when I was young, like, I could conquer the world, you know. I could make a stone religious. Not a stoner that I'm doing today. But I could make a stone religious. And I realized, these guys are 18, those guys are 15. They play basketball together. They schmooze together. They have common interests. They even rebel a little bit together in certain ways, even though they were good, you know, much better than high school kids. That's what happens here. The B'nai Torah, they're friendly. They talk. They're a couple of years apart. It's a formula for success. And that's basically, high school is 9 through 12. And the Beis Medrash is from 18, 19 through Koilo. We have a Koilo here too. That's a very touchy issue. Unfortunately, we have our own problems. Nobody lives here. The town of Cedarhurst is not very conducive to dormitory. They've got all kinds of ordinances. You can't have more than four non-directly related, I don't know, you know, and they're always watching us. We're very popular in the town of Cedarhurst. The mayor Parisi always comes by every day. It's all a mile square, the town of Cedarhurst, so he just, you know, doesn't have much to do, so he's always here all the time. And then he sends his meter maids, you know, to give tickets, and he, you know, is very, very active over here. Anyway, it's dormitory. We have yeshiva dormitories in Far Rockaway. We've taken in a few of the high school kids in those dorms, but that's very difficult. I'm not sure that we're going to do that next year. We can try to, you know, house more with homes. Yeshiva has dormitories. What's that? No, if a kid is from out of town, if a kid can go home, he goes home. But if a kid is from out of town, so we have a few that we've been able to arrange. It's hard. In an affluent community, it's very hard to put in borders because people don't really need the extra money, you know, and they'd much rather have their privacy. But we're working on that. That's a good question. We have started a building campaign, but I wasn't asked to make an appeal here.
15 million?
What's that? No, I don't want that. That chokes you. No, I'm talking a million. I'm looking at a piece of property now for less than $1 million, you know.
No problem.
I'm a little guy, you know what I mean? Anyway.
But you know, talk about discipline.
Yes,
the purifying, there's a lot of fault in the cause, not because of discipline, but the exact opposite. The children will come home, they'll speak about their teachers, and the parents will run the teachers down to the lowest of the low. But the children themselves will then lose respect, and they go to school, they've got no discipline. And
No question about it. I wouldn't say it creates the whole problem. I would say that's a tragic mistake that parents make. And we have to be very, very careful. But that mistake actually leads me to another topic, which I think is also, we don't have much time, which I think is also very important. You know, I'm trying to prioritize which are the most important. I mean, there's lists of topics here and these outlines. Yes. But
that could be one of the reasons for the whole business today. Lack of time. Parents don't have time.
Yeah, there's no question about it. But right now we don't have time, so I want to get... So anyway, so in terms of that, I want to say something else. Not only being critical of the Rebbe, which undermines the system, and not only, by the way, being critical of the parents on the part of the Rebbe, which undermines... I want to tell you something that I heard. I'll tell you what I heard from Rebbe Yitzchok Noble, is married to an einikel of Rebbe Yaakov Kamenetsky. And I heard on a tape from him, so that's the source, as reliable as it is, that when Rebbe Yaakov was a Rav in Toronto, this goes back, you know, many years ago, they had a problem there with the Zman Tefillah. And the shul that he was a Rav in, they davened after the Zman Tefillah on Shabbos. Rebbe Yaakov used to daven the Yechidus. I guess he couldn't change it. the yeshiva bochurim, when they would come home, wanted to have their own minyan to daven bizman. He refused to let them. He said that he doesn't want, because they were from families, but, you know, they weren't very knowledgeable, they were ignorant people, they didn't really know halacha this. He doesn't want to undermine that source of connection to Yiddishkeit that they have with their homes, because if they start feeling, you know, that their family is not frum and they're this, it could leave them, you know, homeless, it could leave them stranded religiously, whatever. So, you know, these are things that we have to be sensitive on both sides. But I'd like to take it a step broader. One of the biggest things that would help prevent problems would and is a dynamic that is critical in the problems that these kids have, and that is inconsistency, or maybe even more directly, hypocrisy. What do I mean? Chazal say, it's a Medrash Rabbah, that when Yaakov was approaching Yaakov Avinu, so Yaakov was mispar. So it's different place in Chazal what the nusach of the tefillah was. We know he said a tefillah. So he says like this, Rebbeinu Shalom. The Torah that you're going to give says, in the Torah it says, Oisev es benoi lois ishchatu b'yayim echod. Yeah? Not allowed. Oisev es benoi in one day. If you will allow Esav to destroy my whole family in one day, and I quote the Loshon, Hatira she'ata osid litein b'sinai mi yikrebo. The Torah that you're going to give at Sinai, no one's going to read it, because it's inconsistent. In other words, he says, not that he'll deny the Torah. The Torah she'ata osid, he doesn't say, he says, mi yikrebo. The Torah is Torah mi Sinai. Oh, but I can't deal with that. Inconsistency. He says, and then he goes and kills. I mean, let's not ask the ramifications for all the suffering in the world, but that's not the topic of discussion, which, by the way, agav, that's also another thing. These kids have to have answers to suffering, because they suffer and they see suffering, and that's part of the problem. But that's, you know, as Rabbonim, I'm sure you deal with that on many levels, so that's really not in the purview of what we have to discuss here. But the inconsistency, if people will see inconsistency, they cannot, I can't respect an inconsistent. I can't respect a hypocrite. Now, a Rebbe has to be very sensitive to this. A Rav has to be very sensitive to this. Of course, you know, sitting up on a bima is even more of a an opportunity to for someone seeing something or imagining they see something as inconsistent, which could. And a mechanech has to be very careful about this, because if they see inconsistencies, and I have to tell you what I found from experience, when a mechanech, and maybe even a parent, but I see it more with the mechanchim, is abusive in some way. I don't mean it as a legal term, but is abusive to a child in a classroom. I find it does more damage and is more resented by the kids that watch it than by the object of the abuse, because the object of the abuse, vinishvi, he has some sense that he did something wrong. He knows, yeah, look, he knows that, even though the kids are saying, well, how do you know he meant something? He knows he meant the chutzpah, he knows it. You know, but the kids just see a Rebbe being inconsistent. He's preaching, he's preaching all these values, he's telling me what to do, and he behaves. And this is critical. These inconsistencies are one of the most severe disappointments that these kids have, and something that's extremely critical to address. Now, there are a couple of other things which I just want to mention before we conclude. I don't know the situation again in England, and therefore I hesitate, but we are fortunate in the New York area and in other communities as well, the main frum community, Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami, that we have a significant number of frum, even B'nai Torah, mental health professionals. I don't know if that's the matzav over there. Well, then that's a problem. But it's maybe that's part of what Rabbonim should be concerned about, to encourage that. You know, there are people here that, although I tell you, the mental health professional is doing very well, it's going to be very hard to entice them to move.
Didn't Moshe really encourage people in the 60s because it wasn't he asked to shine about whether it's Moshe go to a health professional?
Yeah,
not and he came out and said it's also, and therefore a lot of people were encouraged to go to
that. I wasn't aware of that, but that's right. But we have today, Baruch Hashem, I mean, like, and there's even a choice, and there's different types and different, you know, and I know I deal with a lot of them, and for certain things I recommend one, for other things I recommend another, both psychologists, psychiatrists, even social workers. 30 years ago, and again, I don't know how this is relevant to your community, 30 years ago, I would have said, Mi yiten li mental health professional v'ashchenu kenochosh. These guys were destroying us. That you would pay money to take your kid to a guy who's going to undermine everything that you were trying to preach and teach and inspire in your home. Today, I have some of these that I work with. I look at some of them as more mashgichim in the yeshiva rather than mental health professionals. They get paid like mental health professionals. Don't worry about that. Not like mashgichim in the yeshiva, but they, because they mamish care. They're involved. Part of their therapeutic goal is helping this kid in his religious conflict. And the reason for it is very simple. And this is something that we should keep in mind. They're Kimat, because you can't really overgeneralize, isn't a kid that grew up in a religious home that drifted from Yiddishkeit that's ever going to find peace and happiness unless he gets back together with his family and with the Yiddishkeit. Because these kids, more than anybody else, and sometimes it's because they were so sensitive, and usually they're very bright, they know that this Yiddishkeit really has it. Because they've seen it by others that it makes them happy. They just couldn't find the happiness, and they therefore look for happiness other places, but in their heart of hearts, they know that this is where the happiness is, and it didn't work for them, and they would do anything to get back to it and to make it work for them. And sometimes that's the only thing that's going to work for them. So mental health professionals, bringing them on board, or whatever you could do to encourage that they're nurtured or that they're imported or I don't know, but counseling is extremely important. Mentoring is very good, but it doesn't substitute for the situations where you need some professional help. And agav, which I don't have to tell you, besides in terms of the frum world, the mental health profession has made has advanced light years in the last 30 years. Psychiatry in the last 10 years has become so sophisticated. It's. I mean, I see the results. I mean, how almost like a target. Like they could take a medication. Well, years ago they would experiment with 15 medications. So there are times where they can get a medication. It's as if they target it exactly to this chemical in the brain. Lo and behold, you know, like if this kid's a different person. I don't mean changing the personality, but allowing the person, you know, really it goes together with behavior modification. And I rarely recommend the psychiatrist, never, without a psychologist also. In fact, I usually start with the psychologist, and then the psychologist recommends the psychiatrist so that he can monitor what's going on, because you have to work with the person. All the medicine really does is allow the patient the ease and the freedom and the lessening of the pressure and the opportunity to get his act together on his own, which he really wasn't able to do. Anyway, this is something that's very important. Okay.
A very quick question. Given certainly in Leeds, I don't know about London, we don't have from mental health professionals. In your opinion, would it be better to use a non-Jewish mental health professional or a Jewish non-religious, or better just to not deal with them at all? I mean, how...
I tell you, I so agonize with that question, I wouldn't know what to say. I would say like this. I would certainly go like this. I would draw the line of when to start dealing with them further away than I would over here. In other words, if you could possibly do it yourself or get along and you see that it's not really in the realm of abnormal psychology, then maybe you should try, because the sakona of these people. On a certain level, a goy is sometimes safer. And I would say like this. A Jew that's negative, you know, like maybe even a person with a frum background, a Shono Pirish, that kind of thing, can be worse sometimes than a goy. But okay. But then if a Jew is tmimis and nice and sincere and willing to learn, and you can, and I would say more than the parent, maybe as the rov, confront this person, say, hey, listen, this is our goals. You know, and you know, a person has a reputation for integrity. This is our goal. We're interested. We believe. believe that our kids will be best healed, is that conflicting with your professional position? If you feel, yes, I feel it does, because I have to do what's best for them psychologically. I can't take, if you can't take religion into consideration, if you don't have that realization that for a kid who grows up in a religious home, to be religious is what he wants more than anything else, then he's not the man for you. You know, a psychiatrist, however, without those that don't do much counseling, which is most of it, is probably safer, because there he's just giving the medication, and then maybe you could, you know, are there from social workers there?
This is something which I found in London.
In the Midlands.
Single parent families.
Not true.
For example, I've got one kiss with an old mother, and there's no father in the house, and the son has now gone, because the other two children, married, this one has gone and shining on his own, look for discipline. With the increase today of the single parent families, whether it's divorce or whatever the reason, I'm finding that there's a lot of rejection as well from the children, because when does one move in to start helping the children? In other words, to prevent, prevention is better than cure.
Absolutely, 100%. I think it's extremely important. I mean, the cases that we deal with more, where there's a father figure that's missing, because usually that's what happens, is stay with the mother. And this, it's extremely important. That I find that yeshiva bochrim have been able to help a lot. If a kid from a single parent family living with the mother, we get a yeshiva bochrim to take the kid out once a week and to go play ball with him once a week, or take him to, you know, like this big brother system. That's what these big brothers are about. You know, they have that. I think that it does wonders. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not the whole story. It's not going to do everything, but I think that's very important to address early on.
As well, they feel very resentful that they come to shul. Mm-hmm. Other children sitting with their fathers. Right. They've got no one to sit with. But
that's a problem.
Yeah. There's a major
problem.
There's a lot of kids like this. There's getting more and more in London. There was a time when divorce was something you never looked for, but there's no longer a stigma, even amongst the Haredi. What we do is, in our community, I've managed to what we call adopt a child, so they sit with a neighbour or whatever.
What about bringing them up to you?
If they come to you, they take a ship, but they can't sit.
Sinister.
They can't.
Why?
That's my sorrow. I sit down sometimes down
why
there.
Why can't they sit next to me?
Because what you're doing is you're making a spectacle out of them, and the parents would not want
that's
it.
Right,
that
right.
Child, I mean, I've got a case of somebody who's a grandson of a Rav. And if he comes to shul, he's sitting with somebody else. If he sat next to me, Nebuch, Rachmanis, the kids themselves are hypersensitive. They themselves feel they're coming to shul, they've got no one to take them to shul, they've got no one to teach them, to talk to them, and they'll sit next to the Rav, and the Rav will be befriending them. Yes, I do it with all the other children as well, so they come and we talk to shul. But I couldn't do that. It would be so wrong to put them out. That's when you already start getting the kids kicking. Now, they're only 6, 7, 8 years of age, but already they're resentful, they don't want to come to shul. Why should they come to shul? There's no one to teach them. I mean, I know for a fact, I've seen this, and unfortunately I can talk from experience with my Eniko, who's my brother's single parent, and he didn't want to come, so somebody befriended him and is taking him, of course, to shul with him regularly. He comes to me now, he sits next to me and he davens beautifully, but he said to me, it's not fair, I've got no one to talk to me, to take me, and it's a very difficult situation. Baruch Hashem, he's got the support of the fact, but not everybody has that support.
I mean, the only thing I know is that we found that yeshiva bochrim, the very yeshiva bochrim was willing to...
I don't think they can.
They're away. Most of the yeshiva bochrim are away from home. They're not in Talion yeshiva.
We came from Shayoshu, Bekehiva. You know, we live in a different community. London doesn't have
a Shayoshu.
Doesn't have that kind of community.
That's a problem.
Well, the provinces, as they call it, they don't have those...
They've opened a home in Golders Green for what you call...
Yeah, that's what's his name. I met with him.
Yes, from Golders Green.
Yeah.
He's a guy, they're now opening up for girls as well, they want to sell one. Yeah. But everybody knows now. It's the unspoken secret, if you like, or the spoken secret that there's this home for these kids, and it's terrible because they're getting a stigma now. Instead of saying you're helping them, you're stigmatizing them.
These are only kids who are on drugs and are...
No, they're not. This is the problem. They're single. Some of them are not on drugs yet. But because they're going to this place, instead of it helping them, it's mummish doing the exact...
I'll tell you something. You know,
some of these kids really need help. They really got help.
They mummish need
protection. You've got a setup here. You're the Rosh Hashiva, you're the Rav, you're everything. We haven't got that.
I tell you something. That's about stigma. We keep changing the name of the high school. One year we call it the name of the yeshiva, then we say that. that's too much for the yeshiva guys there. It's hurting them, so we go back to a separate. I mean, we try to hide, you know, to avoid that stigma for the kids. But the truth of the matter is, stigma is only one issue. You can't sacrifice helping a kid just because of stigma for two reasons. Number one, because stigma is not the only issue. Number two, because there's stigma anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so if I think the primary focus has to be helping and avoid as much stigma as possible. Like what you're saying is very sensitive. Not to sit up there like that. That makes sense. But there are certain things that, you know, you just can't.
Professionals. We're bringing in what I would call the goody goodies, the do-gooders. But they're not trained. They're not professional. Well, they don't know what they're doing.
Well,
let me just say
one of the things that I suggested actually when I met with this gentleman, and then I would suggest is that even though you people cannot import obviously a whole army of professionals, but conferences that bring in, you know, some of the top people in the field. And that's actually what I'm going to give you this to take, just a sample of one of a, you know, PR on a conference. You could take people for a couple of days. You could take your people who are interested, who are involved, Rabboni, Mechanchim, some of these, you know, people who are running these kinds of things, and you'll be amazed at what kind of, let's call it paraprofessional training can be done in a few days. Then what happens is something else too. They're given a lot of information. They're given access to a lot of additional information they could do on their own. They have contacts here, so that when they have problems, they know who to call and who to consult. These conferences, one of the things that they've done for us, and that's all local, is created a network of, hey, I got a problem, I know to talk to this guy. Hey, I know this guy speaks about this, I know he specializes in this. And, you know, you have to develop
that. All right, but the trouble with the people we're talking about is they're almost like ostriches. Their heads are in the sand. They're basically saying it doesn't exist. It does exist, but
they're I want to tell you something else. Before we started, let me tell you a little. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, they said in this community, Cone brought the drugs to the five towns. Yeah? Today, I'm not saying everyone's saying it, but many are saying, thank God he brought it out of the closet.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org. Where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.